Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Late last fall, Global Ag Invest provided a nice overview of the current state of affairs for our fisheries throughout the world. They explained that global demand for seafood has increased 3.2% per year since 1960. And that's outpacing the 1% annual growth in global population. Additionally, per capita consumption has doubled over that same period. To satisfy this thirst for seafood, fish farming has increased, overtaking wild-caught fish, and is forecasted to be a $250 billion market by 2026. As a result, the demand for fish feed has grown exponentially as well. Now let's take a step back and talk a little bit more about the global fisheries. Currently, we have 3 billion people around the world that are relying on sea protein as their main caloric intake for the day. To get an understanding of this evolving world of seafood, we must first look at the wild-caught fisheries. It's been reported that over 90% of our fisheries throughout the world are stressed or overstressed, and there's a real possibility that we will exhaust some of these major fishing regions around the world within a decade. In the South China Sea, for instance, which supplies most of China, where 40% of seafood is consumed, there's a real concern that due to overfishing, ecosystem loss, and contamination, that their fisheries will be decimated by 2025. Now, it's not that simple in saying that we will continue to move in the direction of farming more fish. It's not just about the higher trophic levels we consume. The issue is, as alluded to in the Ag Invest statement, that much of aquaculture infrastructure is reliant on pulling smaller fish from the sea to feed the larger fish we consume. And the alternative feed stuff for the aquaculture industry is that we feed them soy, often genetically engineered, or other crops grown on land using input-based conventional practices, which lead to an unsustainable, perpetual cycle of robbing Peter to pay Paul. Oh, by the way, the runoff from those synthetics and topsoils are causing vast contamination, algae blooms, hypoxia over the waterways and throughout the waterways, and it's also affecting the living creatures that we are using within our open-caught fishery. Boy, this is very concerning to areas that are economically impoverished and are susceptible to sea level rise and climate change. So yikes, that does not paint a good picture. We have some serious systems issues. What does this mean for future generations, the next generation? And the UN's estimate will have 10 billion humans living on the planet. Well, I don't know. It's a good question and it's a big concern. And I don't know if we're going to get to that 10 billion humans if we continue as business as usual and the approach that we're using for raising our fish and to feed ourselves. Today, we welcome a guest with a solution to some of these problems. A guy who has been working on a technology that could fundamentally impact the lives of millions, if not billions, and work towards a more stable planet. Today, we welcome Larry Feinberg, CEO and co-founder of KnitBio. Hey, Larry, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
Thanks for joining.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So you're located right here in the Boston area.
I am.
Are you a native New Englander?
I'm actually a transplant from New York, but don't hold that against me. I've been in New England longer than anywhere else.
Hey, there you go. That's right. And you've raised a family here?
Absolutely. Yep. I got two young children and a wife, of course.
Very good. And I'm sure they're all eating plenty of seafood.
We do eat a lot of seafood in our house, you bet.
All right. Yeah. So let's start into this and talk a bit about what you're doing with raising bacteria at KnitBio. Can you give us a little understanding of what you're up to?
Sure. Yeah, well, that was a fantastic introduction, and you talked about some really big problems, and I think maybe some of the solution to some of these really big problems is on the microscopic level. So specifically, we're brewing protein. So instead of brewing beer, we're using a traditional fermentation process to convert different forms of low-cost carbon feedstocks to this high-value, nutritious form of protein that's kind of like fish meal in a fermenter. And because you can do this inside a vessel, it's highly controlled. We know exactly what goes in. It's all exactly what comes out, you know, is in this blockchain era that we're moving into. So it's going to be very traceable, very, very repeatable and consistent and high quality. So, you know, as we need to do more with less, this is a really fantastic solution because we can tweak our microorganisms and have different versions of those all sort of operating in the same brewery, if you will, and have multiple lineages of these different forms of proteins.
Okay, interesting. So from my understanding, for instance, shellfish producers have been growing out microalgae for a long time, but the way they do it is usually light form. They're not doing a brewing process, which I think takes a lot of resources, a lot of energy, a lot of volume and space, because the energy and the light has to get to feeding this. But your process is a much more efficient approach to this?
Yeah, it's going to be much more efficient in a couple of dimensions. I mean, photosynthesis is great. Thank God it exists. We have the oxygen in the planet before that. However, as soon as an organism grows and doubles because of light, it starts to block the very light that feeds it. So it's got some real limitations. You can get around that in a fermenter, and you can get to much higher densities of cells and therefore higher productivity.
Okay. Now, what does this mean? I get it when you're doing this for small scale and kind of the brewing process. How do you do this on commercial scale, both in the propagation and then the distribution?
Well, on the production side of it, this is not new. We've been doing fermentation arguably for 10,000 years in the form of beer, but much more recently in the last 100 years for pharmaceuticals and many other applications. It's certainly some of the most gigantic reactors on the planet are for fuel ethanol, for example. These can be easily 1.5 million liters each, and there could be 8 or 10 of these reactors per facility. So, you know, we know how to scale biotechnology. We know how to scale these processes, and there's obviously differences in the organisms that we choose and the products that we make. It could range from simple like cheese and yogurt all the way on to insulin, for example, and everything in between.
Yeah, cold fired, right? The action of using bacteria is something, as you said, it's been around for a long time, and we have it in many different food categories. And in fact, some of our best food stuff come from this. But what I think might be different here is that you're using it as this feed stuff and looking at that. And is it that you like a beer or like the food that we consume, do you create different strands for different types of fish or shellfish that you're feeding?
Yeah, absolutely. So in our library, we usually have 1,000 strains. You know, it takes about a week or so to build a new strain, if you will, and then to validate it. We can go through the whole cycle in a matter of weeks, which very dramatically different from, for example, soybeans or any other plant where you got to wait till next season to see what happens.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the power of biotechnology and fermentation in general, is that you get a lot of increase and you can iterate very quickly. And so with that technology, with that platform, we'll have specialty feeds. We'll have essentially puppy chow or adult chow or senior chow. We'll have things that will help make salmon pink, for example, or help fight off disease, all working off the same platform, all working on the same fermentation technology, but different versions of that organism and that strain.
Interesting. It's a bit like the yeast for a bread maker, right? It's kind of always around. You get your good strands that you keep and you keep cultured and alive moving forward. Did you find, or through experience or through, you know, a lab work, do you find more effective strands that are more efficient and more robust?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to borrow that yeast example, you know, there's some maybe that have a citrus flavor or something that you want to enhance for bubble formation for cheese, or right? There's different applications, different tools in the belt. And definitely we have that as well. Just for our single version of our protein, like I mentioned, we have literally hundreds or up to 1,000 different versions of it, and we can tailor it. And so if we see a property that we really find intriguing, we can turn the dials. And instead of having it be 1x, we can make it 100x. And so that's part of the stuff that we're doing. So the intersection of diet and health is called immunonutrition. And so we're really dialing in to making sure that these animals being grown on the farm under increasing intensive cultivation conditions where there's more vulnerability to disease, et cetera. So you are what you eat. And if you feed these animals better and you give them molecules that help them defend off more disease, you're going to have higher productivity on the farm and ultimately more food on the plate.
Interesting. I saw a teaser that a beer company is launching a Lucky Charms IPA. I don't know if you saw that, an IPA that tastes like Lucky Charms. Do you have any of that in your library?
Well, we certainly have the Taste the Rainbow colors for sure. We have yellows and oranges and reds. So I do feel very lucky to be able to do this. So maybe that's kind of the version there.
Okay. Now, is this something you have a patent on, or is there competition out there for you in this?
We certainly do have intellectual property. We got some real smart scientists on our team that are helping to build out the learnings and protect those filings.
Yeah, the shellfish producers have been involved, and they've been doing it kind of the old school methodology, right? And now we're looking at the next evolution. We're also looking at this, as to your point and to your credit, as it's not just something that they're doing in-house. You're doing this at mass scale, or really as an opportunity for, if 50% of fish is being farm-raised, well, we need some infrastructure we need some sub-suppliers for producing this enough volume to create, as you said, this kind of plethora of food value for the food that we're consuming.
You mentioned some real staggering numbers at the top of the show, and it's absolutely right. I mean, the amount of fish that we pull out as sardines, anchovies, et cetera, as primary fish meal, you know, that's about 5 million tons. Hmm. Well, we're going to need about 15 million new tons of protein just to reach the growth of the market, as you suggested. So how do we triple the amount of anchovies in the ocean? Clearly we can't. But maybe we can dent it a little bit with these single cell proteins and fermenters and potentially some insects that could be grown on food waste, for example, and algae, whether it's also fermentation or light systems. So we're really going to need a combination. And so when folks ask me about competition type questions, you know, the reality is it's an E all the above situation.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're successful, wildly successful, we're still just barely putting drops in the ocean here. I mean,
right.
It's really massive. It's a little scary to think about, actually.
Yeah. Floating more boats, right? There's so many great puns in fisheries.
Thought about that. You're right. The puns never end. And, you know, it's a 10,000-year-old industry. So there's been a lot of time for people to reflect on the commonalities between nourishment and life.
That's right. You're out of the sea a lot, too, right? A lot of time in your hands. Let me read a little quick background on NipBio. Is a Boston-based biotechnology company pioneering advanced nutritional solutions for animal feed since 2013. You offer a range of single-cell protein products that come from non-food feedstocks, as we mentioned. And your mission is to secure the quality and safety of food globally in a sustainable, cost-effective way. So a cost-effective way, if I owned a large land-based recirculating salmon production farm that maybe is feeding soy or, you know, not necessarily worried about the feedstuff of that, how is your product competitive or less expensive, more cost-effective than some of the other products that I might be, you know, buying instead?
Yeah, this is a very price-sensitive market, and the scale that we're talking about, you know, price definitely does matter. So you have to create a value that obviously somebody's willing to pay for. And so, you know, lowest cost is definitely one of the value props. And you think about a farmer, they have so little control when it comes to the weather, so little control when it comes to disease or market pricing. The one thing they really can control is how much they're willing to pay for a feed. And so you have this negative cycle of lowest cost formulation. And so they'll put in lower quality ingredients to keep their costs down, which then, you know, if you and I only eat Cheetos and drink red wine, you know, maybe we're not going to feel so good the next day, right? Mm. And that bacteria on that door handle is going to knock us out the next day, perhaps, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of what's going on the farm. So, you know, we can equal or lower the cost of the feed, which we can do as we mature, but we can also have better performance. So by that, it means the product has to be good quality. So they less mortality, for example, we see improved survival, but we also see better, or at least equal, if not better, taste, which ultimately is what matters. Nobody really wants to pay for all these things, whether it's, low carbon footprint or traceable, or, you know, people want these things as part of their products, but they don't want to pay extra for them. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, if all things are equal, can you bundle in these additional benefits at a price that's equal or potentially even lower? And we think we can. So, you know, it's a little bit of the Tesla model, you know, it's, by the way, it happens to be good for the environment, but dang, it's a fun car to drive.
That's right. There's a lot of sex appeal there and moving in the right direction and making it appealing. And I think that's what we're seeing from a consumer base, right, is that people are becoming more engaged. This is, it's not the industry that's doing this because they want to. It's the consumer that is driving interest of knowing more provenance, backstory, and integrity of their food system. And I think it's been interesting because we can kind of look at those two worlds again of looking at open-caught fishery versus aquaculture. I think aquaculture has been given a bad name. People think overstuffed with antibiotics, three-dimensional CAFO. They think some of the worst-case scenarios. But that is evolving. We're seeing scenarios where people are focused on biomimetic aquaculture facilities. Have you been involved in any of those initiatives where people are trying to tell a better story around aquaculture, starting with the feed stuff?
Great points and great question. There's definitely a very vocal community that I would only eat wild caught. Right. I would never eat farm raised. And, and I often turn to those folks and say, hey, when was the last time you had a wild caught cow or a chicken?
That's right.
And so, you know, it just happens to be we still have that protein source available in the wild. For now, it's really just happens to be this time in human history. Fast forward 100 years from now, that really might not be the case. So, okay, is there a right way and a wrong way to do farming? And the answer, of course, is yes. Just like we realize maybe a cow grown in Vermont might be done differently than a cow in Kansas. And what it eats, corn versus grass, and the amount of room that it has. So there's definitely better ways to do aquaculture. And I think the NGO community has been absolutely pivotal in moving that dialogue. They were some of the more vocal anti-aquaculture folks in the room. But in the last 10 years or so, I think there's been a major shift from those folks in terms of, hey, we have food insecurity around the world. This is one of the most resource efficient ways to produce protein, certainly animal protein by far. It has to be part of the solution. So what is the right way to do it? And so NGOs in general have engaged with the community, with both the feed companies as well as the producers. And I think that's a trusted, independent voice. And so it's been very effective. And so, I've definitely interacted with those folks, including WWF and many other organizations as well.
Okay. Yeah, before we jump out of the food space and talk about other things that microalgae can do, I think you told us what you have on your cheat days, which is red wine and Cheetos, though, right? So, yeah, microalgae, though, is being used, and you had talked or mentioned part of this, in diverse sectors. We've heard it being used, obviously, in the food production, coal firing and beer directly, but also now feed stuff, biopharma, and energy production. So is that the case? Where else, or where has microalgae gone, and where are we going to see it in the future?
So microalgae is part of a larger term, microorganisms, including bacteria, algae, yeast, for example. So collectively, these guys are workhorses, right? And we can make biodegradable plastics from them, for example. Certainly, there's a lot of interest and excitement around protein. In fact, just yesterday, there was a $90 million startup spun out of a local Boston company to develop alternative proteins for human consumption. So there are a lot of different forms, a lot of different attributes. But we mentioned energy before, biofuels, biodiesel, for example. And then, of course, getting into the nutraceuticals and health and cosmetics. So there's really quite a range. And it's interesting. Some of these sectors are better received in terms of technology from the general public. You know, when you mentioned genetically engineered soy, that there's a very specific reaction to that versus there's almost no reaction to insulin that's produced from E. coli that's not now produced from pigs. So it's a very complicated topic and it's a very diverse topic, and glad to at least be talking about part of it.
Yeah, and I think it also comes down to who's doing certain engineering, right? Because if we're engineering it to use more glyphosate, That's very different than if we're engineering to maximize efficiencies or working with other initiatives to actually focus on solving big problems.
That's
right?
A great point. Yeah. I mean, that clearly has an environmental impact. And, you know, it's almost like GMO 1.0 with the environment versus now. I think there's been many decades actually of development. It's moving very quickly. And, you know, we're able to do things that are not just good for the farmer, but good for the consumer and good for the environment. And that's the triple bottom line that we have to hold, including genetic engineering and biotechnology too.
Yeah, it's, I mean, CRISPR being a game changer when we can adapt RNA versus trying to do a Russian roulette with DNA of what's going to stick or not, right? And do you get into any engineering of bacterial elements for or microalgae or some of the things that you're working on for food or energy?
We do have that ability. It's a really powerful toolkit. And you know, having only the ability to breed, for example, like with corn or with plants or animals, you know, that's a very slow and very random process. So what we have is a very strong understanding of what genes do. And we have to then show that it's safe and that we haven't had any unintended consequences. In fact, you know, that's really critical and we have to be very transparent, frankly. I think that's probably where the whole sector went wrong early on, was there was a lot of mistrust and distrust. And so going forward, whether it's CRISPR technologies or others, it's very important, I think, to engage, label, and also educate all along the process.
You had mentioned WWF, and I've also read some of the other environmental stewardship relationships and partnerships that you've been involved and established. And looking at the growth of the space and what we're talking about, the potential magnitude of this, do you see a potential role in impacting people and planet in such a positive manner that you would classify yourself as a potential social entrepreneur?
I definitely agree that I'm a triple bottom line kind of guy. Social entrepreneur tends to get a bad rap that they're not profitably motivated, you know, and I think it's got to be people, planet, and profit.
Yeah.
You know, one of the greatest contributions to mitigating carbon was moving from coal to natural gas, right? I mean, that was way more powerful, at least at the time, than solar panels for a while. You know, now I think that's catching up. But so there has to be an economic basis to actually having real effective social change.
Yeah.
So, yes, I believe in that. But I'm not sure I'm quite ready to be labeled by it just because I want to make sure that it's the triple P's there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would agree 100% that if we're really going to drive change here, we have to be reliant on our free markets to be the one that's going to drive us in that direction. And, you know, I think more people are moving in the direction. We've seen a lot of organizations reclassify themselves as B Corps. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of investment vehicles move down the direction of impact, you know, whether it's double impact or, you know, how many different iterations of that we can look at. And fisheries actually being one of those good examples where we can talk about local dollars spent. We can talk about, you know, the working waterfronts. We can talk about keeping ecological systems clean. But I think also what we're talking about here is just, you know, a better foodstuff, a more reliable energy source, and even trying to harmonize some of this that it can be, I mean, this stuff can be created anywhere, right? I mean, you can do this if you know, and so right now in your model, is it set up that you have one production facility and it distributes from there? Or are you building out labs in different locations, or what's the goal and what's the plan there?
Sure. Well, we actually, about 8 months ago, formed a partnership with a corn ethanol engineering firm. So fuels from corn, you know, there's a fair amount of infrastructure already built. We make about 15 billion gallons. Cars are getting more efficient. We're electrifying our fleet. So the number of new plants going up is obviously very low, if any. And, you know, what I see as a entrepreneurial biotechnologist is an opportunity to leverage that infrastructure. So those guys are obviously smart at fermentation and animal feeds in the form of distillers grains, for example, logistics in terms of railroad tracks. And so there's a lot of interesting things about those sites as hosts. So our idea is to co-locate next to one of these facilities, use one of their waste streams, and upgrade that into a high-value protein product. So it's a bit of a centralized but also distributed model, because these plants, there's about 200 of them throughout the country, and then that's just within the U.S. So, yeah, the idea is to have some fairly large manufacturing capabilities alongside of these. big plans.
Talk about a great scenario of a new baseline for a circular economy too, right? Using a waste stream from one, turning into something very impactful and positive. And really, you know, talk like a similar analogy what you talked before of a of our previous DNA manipulation on GMOs being version one, ethanol and corn production for looking at what we can pull out of nature for energy or for other resources being a version one, whereas you're developing much more efficient tools, taking waste streams and it seems evolving a space that is in dire need of version two.
Absolutely. These ethanol facilities are going to become more like biorefineries in that they're going to cut the essentially the kernel into a lot more slices and have multiple streams and multiple products. And that's really how a petrochemical refinery works. You know, it doesn't just start with the barrel of oil that comes out of the ground. They make lubricants and plastics and lots of different products. And so there's a very similar vision that is emerging in that industry, in that sector now. And I think, you know, when economic hardship comes into that sector, you know, that's a good birthplace for innovation.
Yeah, good analogy. Again, it's you're right. Our roadways, everything come from the byproduct of what we're pulling out of the ground, the ecological dander that we get for fossil fuels at this point, right? But looking at future scope of this, of actually trying to be, you know, neutral, net neutral here, and the fact that we can revert and return some of this, getting down to that lowest trophic level of bacteria or microalgae or however we're going to put this in a bucket, you know, are you really defining and crafting kind of the impetus for a drastic and sequential change across most industries? I mean, are you, I'm going to, there's a softball question for you there. Of course I am. Yeah. But really, is that the case of like, the more you get under the hood here, are you recognizing that as an opportunity for your company?
So, I mean, obviously we're trying to do something big and important. And I think that there's a need to find a way to actually make it work. And so, you know, seeing these opportunistic facilities, for example, that's one example. You know, we're going to have a degree of feedstock flexibility, and so we're going to be able to locate geographically all around the world, and ultimately that's going to matter. And so then the ability to wire our organisms and tune them to make different properties and enhancements, if you will, you know, that this is going to have a whole degree of flexibility. You know, for example, the land footprint for the amount of protein we can produce from these facilities is about 1,000 times less than a soybean farm. The water is almost completely recycled back into the process, so it's going to have a very low water footprint. So how do we, you know, meet that need that you described earlier in terms of creating essentially something from nothing? I think these are the type of strategies, the ones that we're working on are the right ones to help address these really big problems ahead of us.
A bit more in your background. Larry Feinberg is a PhD, is an entrepreneurial industrial biotechnologist and CEO and co-founder of NipBio, as we talked about. Larry completed his doctoral studies at the University of Massachusetts, where he focused on biochemistry and physiology of genetics of microbes. All right? Okay. His deep expertise in early stage technology ventures and bioproduct discovery. And at the Muscoma Corporation, he has also led Organism Discovery Group and New Business Opportunities Team. So how did you get interested in biology in the first place? Was this something that your 10th birthday, you will put on your birthday wish list a microscope? You know, were you into it from day one?
Well, you know, yes. I remember standing outside my hose and, you know, outside my yard with a hose and eroding the back hill, I'm sure, to my parents' chagrin, but like being fascinated by geology, air quotes there, as I'm, you know, washing the mud away. But, you know, like cry to all teachers and educators. You know, I had some fantastic science teachers, some really good teachers in general, but in particular in science, and that really turned me on. And so I went to the University of Massachusetts, and I actually went and got part of a very famous professor's lab named Lynn Margulis, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago now. But, you know, they're very inspirational. She actually, you know, very well-renowned scientist, but she helped inspire my love and enthusiasm for you know, origin of life and potentially life on other planets. And so I went back to school for astrobiology, and I was studying these extreme microorganisms down the in hot springs that might be at the bottom of the ocean, for example, that represent life on Mars, perhaps. And so, you know, at the end of my PhD, about 5 years or so, you know, I said, yeah, there probably is life on other planets. And gosh, it's probably really far away. So while it's fascinating, I better start focusing on this planet. And so I had a real realization that, you know, I need to do whatever I need to do to help and apply those skills. And so at that time, around 2007, we're fighting a war in Iraq and another one in Afghanistan, and oil prices are $140 a barrel of oil. And felt like almost my patriotic duty to develop these alternative biofuels from wood chips and grasses, for example. So, for the first couple of years, I led a scientific team to BioProspect, one of the greatest jobs on the planet, and went to paper mills and scrubbed the slime off the facilities and went through trash heaps and, you know, lots of different mining, if you will, including in more hot springs. And then ultimately, that we developed all the genetic diversity we needed inside the company, and I joined the business development group. Actually, my folks were entrepreneurs, and so I was inspired by them and made the shift about 2 years into my company there. So went and worked on a project in Alberta, and we were for 4 years worked on a biorefinery project up there, converting wood chips into alternative biofuels. And then a funny thing happened called fracking. Yeah. And all of a sudden there was really very little need for alternative biofuels. And so, okay, now what's next? And thinking about actually my own dietary preference, I'm a pescatarian. I haven't had red meat since 1998, which all of a sudden is a long time. I can't believe it, really. So thinking about the sustainability of the oceans and my own food supply and thinking about what was next for me, this was my call to action.
Nice. I think we got to get some more of our, some other thought leaders to have the same epiphany that instead of trying to colonize Mars, we should be looking at the soil underfoot and the oceans that have incredible answers to much of these life questions. So Elon Musk and Richard Branson, if you're listening, listen to what Larry has to say here. I think we got something going on there. So I read that Knip Bio earned a GRAS green light, and I'm probably reading that wrong, so you can correct me, from the FDA for a novel aquafeed protein. What is that, and what's going on with the FDA?
Yeah, thanks. It was a very big deal for us. GRA is generally regarded as safe.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's a couple of different routes in and through the FDA to get a new ingredient approved and considered safe. So I mentioned earlier about transparency, that this is one of the avenues that we've chosen. And we actually first engaged with them in 2014, very early on, and so introduced ourselves and started to enter into the process. And so it was a multi-year process. It was actually the dossier was many, many pages that we put together. Took about 15 months for them to review. And then ultimately they give us the green light. So this is very important in terms of providing comfort to our customers. It's an independent form of validation. There are many jurisdictions, like, for example, South America or Southeast Asia, that regulatory oversight is much lower. So this will provide a degree of comfort to those folks. I would say that there's an opportunity for my peer companies to come together a bit on this topic, because it's a very inefficient process. You know, we spent a lot of years on this single product. You know, we have multiple products in the pipeline ready to go. And so, you know, there needs to be a bit of harmony, I think, not just within this specific ingredient, but across the ingredients. And then even preferably idealistically, which is not realistic, but across jurisdictions. So, you know, have to start the process over in the EU again, or in Japan or China. You know, that this is pretty labor intensive. And at a time when we set the top of the conversation, all this needs to happen now, and has to happen fast.
Yeah, doesn't help when the government shuts down for a month either, huh?
We got caught in that.
You did, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, because this just came out, right? It was within the last couple of weeks. So you're probably waiting with your, you know, sitting on your hands waiting for the next great thing coming for you guys, because this is a big evolution for opening up to that commercial scale that we're talking about.
Yeah, right? It was a source of frustration, but, you know, it's a little bit like childbirth now that we're on the other side of it. I can't remember.
Everything seems great afterwards, right? You forget those sleepless nights. And what are you and I talking about childbirth? We got the easy part. Yeah. We know the strong part of that are. So we got 2 weeks from now, we've got the big North American Seafood Expo coming here to Boston, which is the second largest seafood show in the world behind Brussels. I mean, 25,000 people or more come from around the world. And, you know, they come to Boston to talk about global seafood import export. Much of it is around open caught fisheries, a lot of commodity streams. How has that changed in recent years at the expo to look at aquaculture and feed stuff? And also, do you have any interesting speaking engagements coming at that event?
So I love that event. I've gone many years in a row now. I think that's actually where you and I first met.
That's right.
you know, it is so impressive to me. I take almost the exact same picture every time where I across the walkway and do the panorama. And it's just so powerful and impactful to see, you know, there's Malaysia and Thailand and China. And, you know, it just shows you the global scale and the immensity of this industry and this sector. So it's very, and gives a small snapshot, but it's a big, you know, entry into how big and important this field is. I'm actually not speaking this year. I have for about 2 or 3 years in a row now. So yeah. It's good for me to maybe just go walk around and listen.
Walk the floor, take a look. Yeah. It is interesting too, because, you know, we talk about commodity streams. And that's the biggest problem with food, in my perspective. We treat this as a commodity. And the fact that we then lump all seafood together as we say, you know, the stat is that seafood is the largest commodity in the world, $127 billion commodity. And the fact that everything coming from 70% of the Earth's surface is a single commodity is so interesting. And just kind of talk about the perspective that has to change around how we treat food, our relationship to the planet, all this integration. You know, I think that's a different fish to fry at another time.
Yet puns. Another pun. Yeah, boom. Yeah, never ends. It's great.
That's right. Yep. What else can we expect to see from KnitBio in coming months or in coming years?
So, you know, we continue to grow our team, grow our platform, grow our products. But it's time to start making and time to start getting our product out there in the market. So that's what we can expect now, especially with the regulatory approval. Interestingly, there all of a sudden seems to be this RAS community building in the U.S., recirculating aquaculture systems. So these are on land-based systems. We saw... I actually was able to tour one of the large sites in Miami, Atlantic Sapphire site, this past December. So there's a couple in Maine that are coming online and you know, quite a few already in existence. So this industry is, all of a sudden, we have a homegrown sector of salmon, which, you know, you mentioned before about the transportation and overall logistics. It would be nice. And so some of the specific needs for that industry in that sector, you know, they're believe it or not to dirty the waters here, but their water can get quite dirty, and i.e. yeah. fecal matter.
Yeah.
And so we've shown, at least preliminarily, that the fish that eats our food, it will have a very high digestive tract, you know, very, very strong and solid fecal matter. And so to be able to collect that and not have that dissolve into the water, that helps for the overall efficiency of the operation, but it also helps for the taste and the quality of the animal. So we're going to work with some of those folks, and we're excited to help try to grow the domestic industry of salmon production here.
Interesting. And if we have listeners that are interested in, you know, let's say they own their own recirculating aquaculture infrastructure, or they want to get into it, or they're investors that are interested in this, what's the best place to find more information about you? Is it a website?
We do. Our website's fairly current. And I think we also try to have a social media presence, whether it's through Twitter or LinkedIn, for example, or Facebook. So yeah, we definitely appreciate the community dialogue. I think, again, that goes back to our interest in dialogue and transparency with the community. So, for example, we've published a couple of peer-reviewed journal articles, and we have white papers on our website that can provide some additional information. You know, I think it's really important to partner with the community, whether it's the technical and scientific, the growers, or just the general public in terms of knowing not just where your food came from, but now it's the next level of what your food ate too.
Interesting. Yeah, that product differentiation, right? And I think that spawns that further opportunity as we've talked about. And I'll close by saying, which is quite interesting from my perspective, is look, we have, as we said, 3 billion people across the world that are going to need these solutions, these drastic changes within our lifetime, within the next decade. And for our kids' sake and for their kids' sake, we need a better approach to this. And as you said, Larry, you know, if the fact that we're pulling 5 million tons of small fish out to feed our aquaculture infrastructure right now, that's not going to scale. We need another 15 million tons that is not there and will furthermore never be there. We do need these different types of solutions. And if the fact we can use modern technology, modern science to grow out a smarter approach that is better for the animals, thus better for us, better for the planet, well, I think you got something going there.
Couldn't say better myself. Amen.
Fantastic. Well, Larry Feinberg, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to partake in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.